Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to this episode of What's Next. I am your host, Tiffany Bova, and I am thrilled to have Steve Dennis on the show today. It's like we have been social media friends, you know, we've run into each other at events, and he has a new book out called Leaders Leap, and he reached out and I said, yes, let's have you on and have this conversation. So Steve is a strategic advisor, keynote speaker, podcast host, and the best-selling author of his previous book, Remarkable Retail, which is what I knew him from. He has been named a top global retail influencer by multiple organizations, and his thoughts on future of shopping are regularly shared in his role as a Forbes senior contributor. He is the president and founder of Sageberry Consulting, but prior to that, he was chief strategy officer and SVP of multi-channel marketing at the Neiman Marcus Group, which is awesome. And we'll talk about that. He serves on multiple nonprofit boards, but his new book, Leaders Leap, comes out in April. And I'm excited to have you here, Steve. Thank you.
Well, I'm excited to be here. And thanks for that generous introduction.
Well, we're going to start off with my infamous or famous, depending if you like it or not, yeah. Bullish and bearish. Bullish, you're for it. Bearish, you're against it. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
All right. First one. Fully autonomous retail, bullish or bearish?
Bearish.
Oh, we'll talk about it. Next.
Assuming I understand what it is. But yes, yeah. As I understand it, I would say bullish. Yeah. Or yeah. What did I say? Did I say bullish or bearish? Bearish. Yes, bearish.
Yeah, bearish. All right. The next one, brain implants, which seems to be the news of late. Putting in little chips to help humans do things.
I'm going to say bullish.
Okay. And the next, virtual reality commerce.
Guess I need a time frame. In the nearer term, bearish.
In the longer term, bullish?
Yes.
All right. Let's unpack those two that are in sort of the retail space. The fully autonomous retail, as I describe it, right? Or I always think about it, right? You walk in, there's limited humans there, right? And everything is you walk up and down the aisle, put it in a cart, and either you know, scan it on your own or walk out and it knows what you have and you move on your merry way and you are bearish.
Yeah. Right. Well, I believe it's that sort of thing is going to grow. We'll see much more innovation, et cetera. So it's not as if I think it's not going to get anywhere. I just think folks have consistently, at least over the last decade or so, underestimated physical retail and underestimated our need for social shopping and interaction and engaging with another human being. So I wouldn't be especially bullish on that.
Yeah. And I had, you know, I'm in Southern California. So we got one of the very first sort of, you know, autonomous stores from Amazon. And the first time that I went through it, it was, you know, it feels the same until it doesn't.
Yeah.
Like, you know what I mean? It like feels the same. It feels familiar. You know, you don't normally have people come up to you in a supermarket asking you if you need help. I mean, that right. doesn't happen. So, you know, it still doesn't happen in this case. But then when I did need something, then I was like, then it took, you know, I was sort of, then I'd be gotten onto my search of, do they not have this? Because it's a smaller footprint also,
right?
You know, and you don't naturally know where things are. So that's where I felt it still was a little tricky. And then it sort of fell on me to find it, like through an app, I could find it, but
right. Yeah. Yeah. I generally, maybe just a slight comment on that. I have kind of looked at the world over the last few years, more in the context of the growth of e-commerce, not necessarily this specific thing, as the difference between, and people call it lots of different things, you know, errands versus experiences, jobs versus joys, buying versus shopping, you know, those sort of things. And I think when we're on a mission and we're just trying to get something off our to-do list, if you can take any friction out of the process, and obviously it needs to work, and you need to have some sort of fallback position if it doesn't, I think if you can do that, that's going to grow. But there's just lots of other things where it's more of a discovery process, it's more emotional, and that technology can maybe assist, but it's not, I don't think it's going to kind of take over many of those kinds of shopping journeys.
And then that leads us to the last bullish and bearish question on virtual reality commerce. You said short-term bearish and maybe longer-term a little more bullish.
Well, I heard somebody recently say that the thing with virtual reality type commerce, it's the only technology that makes both e-commerce and in-store shopping worse. And I think, you know, that has a lot to do right now with the state of the technology. And again, you know, some of the reasons why people choose to do more kind of traditional shopping behaviors. But I'm willing to believe that whether we're talking about something that looks like Vision Pro or other types of technology that are out there, that it's going to get a lot better. People will get more comfortable with it. The prices will come down. The form factor will get better. So I just think it's going to take a number of years before it really becomes significant.
Well, I think the underlying commonality between this first few minutes of conversation is change.
Yep.
Right. There's just a lot of change happening in the market, both from a technology standpoint, from customer expectations, from, you know, the where people work, how they work, why they work. I mean, there's a lot of change. And your new book, Leaders Leap, really digs into this sort of need to change to stay relevant. Mm-hmm. But also understanding and maybe accepting that what they were doing in the past that might have worked no longer works. Sure. And so they have to kind of find their way to starting down the path of something new. And I'm going to guess this was, I don't know, maybe you wanted to write a second or a third book, you know, your next book, whatever, however many it's been. And this kind of idea popped up, or it was just having multiple conversations that felt fairly similar and you're like, maybe I should put this pen to paper. So maybe you can walk us through that.
Yeah, people have asked me what was the impetus for the book, and I've tried to think through it because it's definitely something that's happened over an extended period of time. In some cases I could put, or in some respects I'll put the origin of it back to my time at Sears. I started my career in the early 90s. And I don't know if you've heard, but Sears hasn't done so well in the last bit. And you know, it's always struck me, and you know, every story about companies that get into trouble has its own reasons, own dimensions, etc. But you know, Sears was the biggest, most powerful retailer on the planet 40, 50 years ago, and now it basically doesn't exist anymore. And I can tell you from having worked there for 12 years, it was really clear what was happening to us. Like sometimes people would say, how did you not know that Home Depot and Lowe's were going to steal all this market share? And I'm like, oh, guy in my team built a model in 1991 predicting what it would look like. And then when I became the head of corporate strategy at Sears, which is probably the most oxymoronic title that exists in corporate America, in 2001, I said, hey, you know, we built this model a while back. Can we look at it? And pretty much like what was predicted is what exactly happened, just that we didn't do very much about it. It was this kind of slow motion crisis. And then as I got out into the world, I mean, a little bit during my time at Neiman Marcus, but Neiman Marcus, when I was there, was a very healthy company. And, you know, some things maybe haven't gone their way since, but not nearly the kind of problems that Sears had. But as a consultant and analyst and observer, you just see time and time again, companies that just fail to make the transition and deal with the new world. One of the things I've been saying as I've started to talk to people about the book is I often look at companies or look at leaders and say, if the world has changed so much, why have you changed so little? Because I don't think I'm pointing out anything in this book that most people don't know. I mean, hopefully there's some insights in my description of the situation. But the point is not really to convince people that the world is changing faster or that if you don't change, you might find yourself into trouble. I mean, I set that up a little bit, but the main point is to get at, well, what do people get wrong? Why do we see this constant engagement in what I call a timid transformation? Because it's not so much that people don't realize the need to change. They just have a hard time doing it, as evidenced by, you know, not just things we see in retail, but plenty of other companies and industries.
Yeah. And it's, you know, who wants change and everyone's hands goes up, who wants to change, everyone's hands go down, right? It's that paradigm. But also I feel like the, you know, like you've been doing this for a little bit, that the pace of change has accelerated around a category now that you can't avoid, i.e. technology, right? Yeah. So if you take Moore's law, right, of things are going to get cheaper and faster every 18 months. But the other side of that is it's not just getting cheaper and faster. It's that more things are also being developed. More things are coming out of that Moore's law.
Sure, right.
Even faster. And so, you know, companies may have had 2 to 4 to 5, quote unquote, change transformation projects that were related to technology a decade ago, mm-hmm. and now they're over 10. And right. You just can't absorb that much change. I mean, you know, maybe the executive team can because they write a check and they're not having to change much because mm-hmm. yeah. they're not using the technology. But as an employee, you're like, my God, like I don't have time to absorb the last thing they gave me. And now they're throwing something else out at me.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think as I point out and others have, the change we see generally is starting to become much more exponential than linear. And some of that is Moore's Law. Some of that is you know, the cloud technology. I mean, you know, there's lots of different factors. It depends on where you sit, exactly what it is. And obviously now we've got generative AI, which is a whole, you know, thing that a lot of people didn't even see coming really, you know, 18 months ago. So I think the pace of change continues to accelerate. At the same time, you've also got, and I guess this is related to technology, but customers becoming more demanding because they have more access to information, because they can get pricing, because they're influenced by social media or whatever it might be. And then you've got competitive models often coming out of nowhere, or, you know, like I think about, and this book is not just about retail, just to be clear, but I certainly lean on my retail experience. And I think lots of readers are more familiar with the retail examples than they would be, you know, the pork rendering business or something, you know, pretty obscure. But, you know, you see, you know, retail, if you go back 30 years, as you would know, was basically all done in physical stores, you know, some mail order catalog. But the way retail progressed had mostly to do with, you know, Walmart opening a bunch of stores, Home Depot opening a bunch of stores. Well, now we've got so much that's done digitally. And in B2B, you've got, you know, SaaS models. And so these are businesses that can scale in many cases much more rapidly than, you know, Starbucks can build 10,000 stores. So I think just this, you know, which is enabled by technology, but it also allows new competitors to often come out of what appears to be nowhere. So there's so many forces that amass to put pressure on businesses that don't adapt or don't see it coming or haven't figured out how to respond.
And so is the leap in leaders' leap the incremental changes, you know, or is it, what is the leap of, I'm going to guess kind of almost leap of faith. That's kind of what I hear when I read that, you know, in my head, when I go leaders' leap and I kind of go like a leap of faith, right? Is it?
Well, it's funny, actually. I took, in the editing, we took out, there was a little riff that I was doing on kind of leap of faith, and I kind of hint at it, but no, I think it's a few things. It's really that, you know, slow and steady incremental change is likely in many industries, many situations, to put you further and further behind. So you have to aim higher in the value you deliver, which I know you get into. And I think your most recent book, you talk quite a lot about raising the bar, right? And the bar continues to be raised on what customers want, what kind of experiences you have to deliver. So our mutual friend, Seth Godin, talks about being remarkable, but to really, really be intensely relevant and differentiate yourself. So that as the bar continues to be raised, if you don't aim higher, you're likely falling further behind. But as the pace of change, if you don't move faster, you know, this gap can emerge between what the market requires and what you're able to deliver. So some of it is really just this leap that if you don't act more boldly, fundamentally, you're likely to fall further and further behind. But what's kind of the core of the book is really talking about, from a leadership standpoint, what, you know, mindset shifts do you have to make? And I call them mind leaps because it's a little bit more of a paradigm change than just kind of these incremental improvements. But one thing I'm trying to make clear is I'm not suggesting that companies or organizations need to just engage in a series of moonshots. You know, that's not what I'm trying to get across. I mean, you've got to do a lot of incremental things, a lot of business optimization, a lot of what Clayton Christensen originally called kind of sustaining disruption or sustaining technology to keep pace. But in many cases, if you're not able to take those bigger leaps, then you risk being irrelevant, or you risk, and as we've seen in many cases, companies actually going out of business.
So if, you know, people are listening to this and maybe they're a first-time leader or they're a long-time leader and they're kind of going, okay, well, all right, so now what, right? Mm-hmm. Like, what is the Monday morning to-dos, right? If I go, sure, where do I even begin to find out if I am just doing incremental or if I'm being more bold? You know, how do I figure out what's working, not working, you know, so I can place my bets? Because I'm guessing this is about making decisions about where you're going to have the greatest impact, mm-hmm, eventually. Yeah.
Yeah. So in the book, I suggest 7 mind leaps, and I would say 4 of them are kind of strategic prescriptions and 3 of them are more personal characteristics. The one that I would mention, I think it's kind of the easiest to understand and respond to your question, is, well, the chapter itself is called Wake Up, but it's really more about doing the work and opening the aperture. Because I think a lot of times what leaders miss is they're not really sufficiently aware of what's going on in their business. You know, they're too narrowly defined, their competitive set, Perhaps they've not really dug into a level of customer insight that really helps them understand whether or not acquiring or growing or retaining the customers that they need. They may not appreciate that competition may come from outside of the traditional play. So, for example, just pick one that most people are going to be really familiar with. It's not as if Uber and Lyft are a better taxi service. They are a really different way of accomplishing the job that the customer wants to be done. So if you were just running a taxi business, you know, traditional taxi business, and you're thinking about how to improve it, well, you're not paying attention to the right things. You needed to be paying attention to how buyers and suppliers could be married up through the use of technology. You needed to get away from this idea that, well, gee, you know, should I have more EV vehicles or not, right? It's because Uber and Lyft didn't rely on the same way of managing a fleet of taxis. And, you know, Airbnb, Vrbo are sort of the same thing. So I think opening this aperture to understand what customers are trying to accomplish, more of kind of customer jobs to be done or solution mentality, is one way to get there. But it's just paying a lot more attention to what you're doing, not assuming that some of the things you believed about success will get you there. And that gets to just quickly one other thing I talk about in the book, you know, is how our ego often gets in the way. I think one thing that we've seen a lot is, and I'll go back to the retail example, is so many retailers that have been struggling for a really long time continue to basically rely on the same set of skills and capabilities that made them successful in the past. The problem is that what got them there is not going to get them in many cases to where they need to go. So you also have to be realistic enough, break through your denial to say, well, you know, maybe my set of tools is not the right set of tools anymore, and be willing to defy conventional wisdom or kind of unlearn things and just be a little bit more vulnerable and honest about what you need going forward. So it'll depend on where you sit in the organization, what sort of business you're in. But I think being open to see where your preconceived notions may not serve you well and doing, frankly, more and different homework is definitely one of the starting places.
Yeah, I mean, I often say, you know, the sort of the beginner's mind versus the expert's
right, exactly.
mind, as you say as well in your book. And, you know, to me, it's all about getting really uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. And I always sort of challenge, if you show up to work and at the end of the week, you didn't feel uncomfortable at all in what you were doing, like, I don't know how to do it, I'm scared to do it, I'm anxious, you know, you're not getting any of those feelings. You're just like, yeah, it was a good day. You know, it was a good week mm-hmm. at work. Kind of did a lot of the same. You know, no real issues came up. I, you know, performed, checked the box. But you don't leave that week like going, oh, like I feel like I really didn't do a good job. Or, you know, you've stretched yourself. Mm-hmm. Then maybe you're not asking those questions in a way that the aperture is fairly narrow right. on expert mind, right? Versus
sure.
the wider makes you feel much more uncomfortable.
No, absolutely. And one of the things I talk a lot about quite a bit in the book is trying to understand your fear. And, you know, when I look at my own experience where I haven't done some of the things that I needed to do, it was often because of some folks may know Stephen Pressfield's work on resistance. It's, you know, this fear or this resistance comes up, and that resistance could take the form of, I might look stupid, or just a sense of discomfort that nobody likes because I'm unskilled in this area, or everybody else seems to know about this, but I don't really get it. You know, there's any number of ways you might get fired, you might get, you know, ridiculed, et cetera, or people just will figure out that you don't know what you're doing, which was something that I confronted a lot in my various jobs. But no, there's the fear is often what keeps us stuck. And so I think trying to understand that part of the process of growth, part of the process of innovation is inherently defined plenty of times when you're going to feel uncomfortable because you may be developing and learning a new skill. You may be doing something that's never been done before, which just inherently means that it may not work. And I'll go back to a Seth Godin quote, which I don't include in this book. I included in my first book, which is, if failure is not an option, then neither is success. And you really just have to get your head around that. And it's, you know, there's lots of, for better or worse, there's lots of cute little quotes and mantras and whatever around failing better and all these kinds of things. But, you know, in my experience, it's true. But if you're going to really lead something meaningful, something truly transformative, you're going to have to get comfortable with your fear. But first, you've got to actually notice it and understand it and figure out ways to deal with it, but also find out ways to manage it. Like, it's, again, back to what I said before, this isn't about just finding some wild idea and putting all your money on one number in Las Vegas, right? It's, there's ways to manage and build culture of experimentation and other processes that allow you to cope with your fear. But if you can't understand that fear is part of that growth process, then maybe you should go do something else, frankly.
Well, and I want to hone in on the word leap as well. I know we were sort of saying, is it leap of faith, whatever, but you know, is it small pivots? Is it try something a little bit different every day, and then by the end of a month or two, you've leaped? Or is it, I'm going to not just incrementally do these little changes, I'm going to like really go for a bold swing at the fence, which, by the way, may totally fail. But to Seth's quote, and everybody else is around this topic, right? Yeah. It's like, you know, so do you think incremental is not the way here? That if a leader is not sure what to do, that the first thing they should do is really do a big, bold move?
I hate to give you the it depends answer, but I think the real answer is it depends. But I think almost in everything I've ever worked on, there's very few companies that just take one big, bold leap. It's usually a portfolio approach and a series of things. One of the reasons, though, which hopefully gets a little bit more specific to your question, one of the reasons the subtitle is transforming, how to transform your company, or transforming your company at the speed of disruption, is part of what you have to figure out is what is the speed of disruption in your industry. So if you're in an industry which is being disrupted very, very quickly, chances are you're going to have to take more bolder leaps. If you're, I don't know, in the dry cleaning business, where the speed of disruption, I'm guessing, is, you know, on a scale of 1 to 10, probably a 1, then you probably are not, you're not putting anything at risk by a slow and steady approach. But, you know, kind of everything in between, right? So I think the main thing is to figure out where you really sit, accept the emerging reality in your business, understand the speed of disruption, and then you've got to figure out, okay, what are the set of options I have? And if you are, you know, really falling further and further behind, then yeah, you're going to have to be aim higher, move faster, act more boldly at a much greater rate. If you're going through something more in the middle ground, it's probably a series of things. And the key thing is to figure out how to kind of shrink the change, as the Heath brothers talk about. You know, how do you think, oh, I want to get to that place in 5 years' time? Doesn't mean it's just one project, get everybody behind it, lay out a 5-year plan, right? It's likely a series of things, a series of experiments that'll help you get closer to that next milestone. So there's a lot, you know, and in this book, I'm not trying to lay out a ton of detail around the process changes, because there are lots of books that do a very good job doing that, or get into different pathways like you have in your book. I'm really trying to say, you know, let's get to the heart of why, in the face of so much change, your organization and you as a leader are stuck, and trying to dissect that. It's almost, I mean, there's a decent amount of prescription in the book, but I also hope there's a decent amount of like whack in the face and inspiration that, you know, you can do this. And there's a few things that will get you closer to the answer for your organization.
So I'm going to put you a little bit on the spot here. Are there any companies that you think have done a really good leap of late? Like, where you've gone, oh, that was a leap, right? That was not incremental. That was definitely a leap.
Well, this isn't super quick, but the one I often use, hopefully many listeners are familiar with, is what was formerly known as Restoration Hardware has done with their business. They, if people remember 10, 12 years ago, Restoration Hardware was almost out of business. They had a lot of these tiny stores that were just kind of a mix of some towels and some tchotchkes and gift items. And then Gary Friedman, their CEO, and team got this concept for their RH Gallery stores, which, if people have been to those, they are massive, beautifully decorated. They have pool, restaurant, and so forth. So, you know, he took a concept that was, you know, in the home furnishing space generally, but created something quite bold and quite new. And now the company, you know, just several years later, is completely different. The performance the last year or so hasn't been that great because some of the headwinds in the home industry. But, you know, that was a company that really took a totally different, I mean, same general vicinity, but defined their customer and the experience, and then put a store concept together that's really been powerful and has generated, I forget how many billions in sales at this point.
And then what's the opposite of that, right? Took a bold leap And maybe, you know, sometimes it's a bold leap. And I often say it was the right idea, wrong time, right? Like, I mean, but, you know, yeah. Netflix was not the first to come up with the concept. You know, Blockbuster right. actually was, or Kodak for digital photography. You could say right concept, wrong time. Sure. And then they abandoned it, right? So it could be somebody made a leap and it just, and you were surprised that it didn't do as well as maybe we, you know, the market might have thought.
I'm not sure I've got any top of mind. I mean, there's certainly some noteworthy examples, you know, Meta with the metaverse, Amazon with the Fire Phone, you know, in retail, 10, 12 years ago when Ron Johnson was the CEO at JCPenney, he made a number of changes very quickly, which were probably pointed in the right direction. But it's actually that particular one is a good example of somebody who didn't understand enough the pace of change that could be absorbed. But he was absolutely right that to continue going on a kind of slow and steady, slightly better version of what they were doing was going to be death over time. So his instincts were right. I think the execution of it, given the business tanked like 30% the first few months that he took over, the instinct was right, but the devil was in the details. So I don't think it was necessarily too early in that case. That was just really not understanding the situation well enough to build a plan. But the instinct to do something fundamentally, you know, bold and different was on the money. And now Penny's.
Yeah, I think but that also highlights that just because it worked in one industry doesn't mean what you were successful doing previously, and then you take over a CEO role at in another company, which could, you know, loosely say be similar, and right. then just apply that same playbook and then be surprised it didn't work. Like, you know, JCPenney's is not an Apple store.
Exactly. You know? Yeah. And I think that actually, even though I don't talk about that specifically in the book, I think in that case, that was a good example of where the ego got in the way, that, you know, this belief that I've figured out sort of this magical formula and I'll apply my playbook to what at face value, like how hard could this be? I mean, I think there was a lack of humility there on the part of several people that were involved that got in the way. So it's a good example of, you know, recognizing that bold change was needed, but because you didn't do the work, because you weren't humble enough, you ended up getting a bunch of things wrong. And, you know, it really didn't need to happen. I mean, you know, they could have had, I think, much more success if they had approached in a different way.
Yeah. In Growth IQ, I actually cover Sears at nauseam in one of my stories that there is absolutely no excuse that Sears didn't own the smart home market. Like mm-hmm. they had all the stuff
yeah,
that was absolutely. Smart home. You know what I mean? So some of that is, you know, companies actually have all the right ingredients mm-hmm. to put together a beautiful meal,
right.
if you will. Mm-hmm. Right. But then they either cook it too long or, you know, don't add the certain ingredient and then they just ruin it. And I think that goes back to that leader's leap. You're just not going to always get it right. But if you're willing to take the shot, I think you've got a great chance at being successful. And, you know, I got, while I said, you know, Steve's got a new book coming out, Leader's Leap, as I've mentioned a few times, I actually got an early read of it and endorsed the book.
Yes. And thank you very much for yep, that.
And I don't do that unless I'm like, look, I buy in, I sort of, you know, spend time in it and go, will this be helpful? And will it mm-hmm. really add value? And I think as with experience mindset, I called out the term mindset because I believe mm-hmm. that's what this is. It's like, how do we get people to shift how they view something, how they think about something, what they're willing to do? And to me, that isn't necessarily strategy. That's just how you put it on paper, right? But it has to start with that mindset. So with that, Steve, you know, what would be, you know, the one thing that you hope people take away from the book? Knowing everything that we've already talked about?
Well, I think the main thing, which is maybe a little bit more vague than you're going for, is to see themselves in the book in some way, shape, or form. Like, I hope I've given enough personal examples as well as case examples as well as stimulus for them to go, okay, yeah, that is a thing or two that I really struggle with. And here are some ways to think about it. I also ask, as I know you've done in your books, also put some questions at the end at several of the chapters, because part of the problem, which I imagine, well, you can tell me if you struggle with this as well, when you're trying to write something which hopefully has impact outside of more than just one industry or a big company, small company, profit, nonprofit, you know, when you're covering the landscape, so to speak, it's hard to get super specific and have it resonate. So hopefully there's good bones there. And then these questions help people internalize, say, okay, for my business, how am I doing on these dimensions? So I hope that that's useful as well. But mainly if they can see their themselves in their company or organization's situation in the book, and then say, okay, let me go into some of these questions and see what specifically I can take out of that and start hopefully changing, you know, that day, the next day, but soon, because there's no time like the present to get going on some of this stuff if you're already behind in particular.
Well, well said, Steve. And thank you again for joining us on this episode of the What's Next podcast. I'm your host, Tiffany Bova. Don't forget to subscribe, tell your friends, and pick up a copy of Leaders Leap, Transforming Your Company at the Speed of Disruption by Mr. Steve Dennis. Thanks, Steve, for joining us.